The Devin Nunes Podcast separates fact from fiction. Stay informed. Download the Devin Nunes Podcast today. Available for free at iTunes.
Welcome back to the Devin Nunes Podcast. This week, we're going to have back on Tom Joslin, who is one of the world's foremost experts in counterterrorism. He has tracked Al-Qaeda and ISIS and every other terrorist group in between. He's the senior editor at the Long War Journal. Tom, welcome back. And this week, we're going to talk about the history of ISIS. We're going to start when ISIS was actually Al-Qaeda in Iraq. So, Tom, why don't you take it from there?
Sure. Well, I think that's a great start, Congressman, on how to frame this, because ISIS, you know, for a lot of people, it sort of gained attention in 2014 when it mushroomed over, conquering a large expanse of land in Iraq and Syria and declaring that they had restored this caliphate to power. And this is a very important and powerful idea, the idea of the caliphate. It's something that the last caliphate, or so-called caliphate, it was really an empty shell, sort of folds up, the Ottoman caliphate folds up in 1924. And there were extremists that agitated in the decades since then to try and resurrect it, to try and resurrect a new caliphate to take its place. And Al-Qaeda becomes at the forefront of that effort. They decide that they're going to get behind the idea very early on, Al-Qaeda does, that they're going to build an Islamic caliphate in these various areas. And they're going to sort of take over political power from the authoritarian regimes that are in these different areas and install Islamic governments over them. And so Al-Qaeda, after the Iraq War is launched in 2003, they begin to invest their resources in Iraq. And Al-Qaeda's leadership endorses the idea very clearly and loudly that they should build an Islamic state in Iraq. And so in 2006, actually a top Al-Qaeda lieutenant, a guy named or known as Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, I consider him to be the real founder of the Islamic State, because in 2006, October 2006, his Al-Qaeda branch declares the Islamic State of Iraq, and then in November of that year, he declares that he's now loyal and part of the Islamic State of Iraq. And he says at the time that this is going to be the cornerstone of the caliphate. And this is an idea that before he says this and after he says this, Al-Qaeda's leadership, both Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, they very strongly support this whole idea, this whole endeavor, that they're going to build this new Islamic state, this Islamic emirate in Iraq. Now, what happens is, if you flash forward to April 2010, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir and his compatriot, a guy known as Abu Omar al-Baghdadi, they're killed in a high-profile U.S.-led counterterrorism operation with Iraqi support. And these guys are taken out, and the U.S. thinks, well, we've just taken out these guys who were very important to Al-Qaeda and Iraq's aspirations to build an Islamic State of Iraq. And so this is a big damage to their cause. Well, what's interesting is they're replaced by another unknown guy known as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. And of course, in 2010, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi assumes control of the Islamic State of Iraq. Now, if you flash forward a few years now, by the way, at the time, there are indications that he was certainly loyal to bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, that he was still in the Al-Qaeda fold when he takes over the Islamic State of Iraq in 2010. But you flash forward to 2013, and the story has shifted dramatically. And what has happened is that both Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and the Islamic State of Iraq and Al-Qaeda senior leadership, they've sprouted into Syria, and they've built a new group called Al-Nusra Front, which was secretly supposed to be part of Al-Qaeda, unannounced, but was going to basically lead the charge for these organizations in Syria. And a big turf battle ensues over who controls this in Syria. And Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, one of the ways you can think about this is he was basically a captain in the Al-Qaeda mafia. And the overall don at this point in time in 2013, this is a couple years after bin Laden had been killed, is Ayman al-Zawahiri. And this captain, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, says, you know what? I don't want to be the captain in the Al-Qaeda mafia anymore. I want to be the don. And so he just defies orders from Al-Qaeda senior leadership and says he wants to take in charge of the jihad in Syria. He wants to take over. And that now this new organization, as he launches it as the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. And that's where we get the name ISIS from, the Islamic State of Iraq and Sham, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. And so he launches this in 2013, 2014. By 2014, the middle of 2014, after they've consolidated a large expanse of land across Iraq and Syria, Baghdadi and his lieutenants declare that they're now going to be known as simply the Islamic State. And they're going to expand expand and sprout, not just in Iraq and Syria, but around the globe. And what you see is they basically start to try and cut into the market share that Al-Qaeda had in various areas. They start competing for the loyalty of various groups everywhere from West Africa to Southeast Asia. And they want these groups, these existing jihadis, to defect to the Islamic State's cause, to say they renounce their allegiance to Al-Qaeda just as Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had done, and they've come over to our cause now, and they're part of the Islamic State, and we're going to build these so-called provinces of the Islamic State in all these different areas. And they have some success in doing that. Now, they have limited success in attracting established Al-Qaeda guys. Very interesting. A lot of people miss this, but a lot of the Al-Qaeda A-team basically stays loyal to the mothership. However, the Islamic State recruits a lot of the younger jihadis, a lot of the hotheads, to their cause. And so they're able to mushroom fairly quickly in a lot of different areas. And so to this day now, you have both the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, where they've lost most of their territory, but they're fighting on as insurgents. But they also have these so-called provinces in various areas, whether it be Afghanistan or a smaller presence in Yemen and Somalia, or a smaller presence in West Africa, small presence in Libya, the Sinai. They have these provinces, so-called provinces, they're still fighting in the name of the caliphate. So it's still a worldwide terrorist organization that's fighting on behalf of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
And still capable. So there's been a lot of talk that that ISIS is completely wiped out. But the reality, even in Iraq, northern Iraq, and eastern Syria, there still are, to this day, pockets of ISIS still there and still going.
Yeah, you know, they're still fighting. Look, it was an important thing for the U.S. to do, to take away their territory and take away their caliphate claim that they control this territory. And, you know, we don't really know how much of an effect that's going to have on their cause in the long run. It's definitely taken out some of their steam because, you know, their big triumphalist message that they were now the caliphate and they're the big bad jihadis in town and they've taken over, they can't say that as much now.
Yeah, and an important thing to remember, Tom, that we glossed over just a little bit. But when ISIS stood up and basically kind of took over the label from Al-Qaeda, people forget they were all the way to the gates of Baghdad. They had nearly got to Baghdad at one point. Finally went back in, after leaving Iraq, we had to go back in and then force them out. That took us probably, I'm guessing now, in excess of $100 billion.
Yeah, I mean, it's cost us a lot of money to stop their caliphate, but I mean, to make them lose their territory, and they certainly fight on, as you said. I just say, you know, the thing is, without the U.S., it's not clear how they would have lost that caliphate, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You know, the bottom line is that the main fighting force in Syria that took the fight to them, that sort of liberated these different areas, was these Kurdish forces fighting under the banner of the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they call themselves. And there's a whole complicated history there that we don't have time to get into.
But we don't have time to get into it. We could do a whole other show just on the history of the Ottoman Empire and the breakup of the Ottoman Empire.
Right. That's right. But the bottom line is that if the U.S. doesn't back them and organize them and give them arms and training and intelligence and air support and all these other key logistical things, there's no reason to believe that anybody was going to eject the Islamic State from these strongholds in northern and eastern Syria, let alone these other areas of Iraq. So, you know, there's a lot of talk today about what America's role should be in the world and how, or even if, we should be fighting the jihadis. And I'll just say, you know, one powerful example, America certainly made a number of mistakes in this long war. However, you know, without America, you know, ISIS wouldn't have lost its caliphate, or its territorial caliphate anyway. I don't think there's any case to be made that it would have. And the bottom line is that you have other sort of jihadi threats that are surging now across the board, including Afghanistan, where ISIS has a presence, according to the UN, of a few thousand fighters. And of course, you have the established Taliban and Al-Qaeda presence, which is much larger. But the bottom line is that this is still something that's ongoing, and I worry as we look forward here that sort of the will to sort of support any kind of endeavor to turn these guys back has been lost, and I think that means they're going to make more gains in the near future, whether ISIS or be Al-Qaeda and the Taliban or some other affiliated groups.
And I think what the American people are really grappling with, and policymakers like myself, is, you know, we've spent a lot of blood and treasure trying to contain this threat. To a major degree, we've been very successful, but it's been very costly. I mean, there's not a community around the United States that has not lost a soldier or service member in, you know, all over the United States, over 5,000 now in these wars. And of course, it's cost us a lot of treasure. So I think the challenge we have moving forward is, you know, how do you ultimately get the Arab countries in that region to stand up and have some type of force that can go out and take on these terrorist forces. And that's that needs to be one of the goals. You have whatever's going to happen ultimately in Afghanistan that remains very unstable. And so it's finding, I think, a balance of not having the U.S. always out in the lead, but for sure trying to have the U.S. do some building and supportive forces. But hopefully those countries in the Middle East can actually put up most of the money. I think that's the ultimate goal, Tom. But as you said, there's no easy answer here to any of this problem.
Well, I'll just say a couple quick points on that. I mean, the first thing is I would say, remember, there weren't any Arab countries that ejected ISIS from its caliphate. It was actually Kurdish forces, not the Arab governments of Saudi Arabia or Egypt or any of those. None of those countries, anteed up and put together an effort to destroy the territorial aspect of the caliphate anyway. And that's important to keep in mind, that it actually was these separate Kurdish forces. So far, the Arab countries have not rallied around this idea and made this a sort of a central pillar of their defense strategy. Far from it. The second thing is, the U.S., we're very sensitive to, American losses, of course, and you have to be very cautious about, how much you want to commit American forces on the ground. We certainly get that. But, if you look over the last year and a half, almost the vast majority of the fighting was actually done by the Kurds in Syria and by Afghan allies in Afghanistan. Last year, I don't know the exact number, but I think it was two dozen or less Americans died across all these theaters where they were fighting, the jihadis, whether it be ISIS or Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, whereas thousands upon thousands of Kurds and Afghans died in the fight. So that's not to minimize the losses to those American families, of course not. But I think we have to keep in perspective that right now we've already shifted the burden in large part to allied forces who are carrying, in terms of both, certainly in terms of blood, maybe not in terms of treasure, but in terms of blood, they're carrying the lion's share of the burden right now. And so my view is that all this should be questioned, and I certainly don't have the answers about how we fight this going forward. I'm just concerned that we still have these basic problems in terms of defining the enemy and what they're trying to do, and that we have sort of lost the will to contain them in some different areas, and that will probably be something that costs us down the road.
What I always say, Tom, is wars don't end until the other side is completely eliminated or completely gives up. And with both Al-Qaeda and ISIS, that's not the case. So the war is not over just because some people say it might be over. And that is the challenge for us moving forward. Tom Joslin with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, the senior editor of the Long War Journal. You can follow him at Tom Joslin on Twitter. Tom, thanks for being on, and we're going to have you back on to talk about the history of the Ottoman Empire at some point.
Well, thanks a lot, Congressman. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Tom. This is Devin Nunes. Until next time, thanks for joining us on the Devin Nunes Podcast.
Storm clouds been gathering so long, I don't know.
The darkness around us leaves no easy road.
We started wondering if every road dead ends our dreams. It whips the dust up and rains pouring down.
Good people struggling in every hometown.
We've started wondering if we even matter at all. We'll take that hard road to happier days. 'Cause we've kept our American faith. Not our first trial by fire like this.
It's nothing hard work and family can't fix.
We've got the power to save it all here in our hands. We'll take that hard road to happier days. 'Cause we kept our American faith. We the people, free and strong, fight through the dark night toward the dawn. Freedom marches on.
prayer and a purpose, we're already half the way there. We'll take that hard road to happier days, 'cause we've kept our American faith.
Paid for by Devin Nunes Campaign Committee.